This podcast series is brought to you with the kind support of Romco Metals, producers of truly green aluminium, copper, and other non-ferrous metals from the African continent, dedicated to decarbonizing supply chains across the globe by recycling our way to a sustainable future. Romco, invest, reduce, and grow. As well as Mbuyu Capital Partners, an investment company focusing exclusively on Africa, managing portfolios of funds and direct investments for institutional clients and impact investors. Our next guest believes that Africa is the biggest gap in sustainability infrastructure globally, and he is on a path to change that. Find out how his business venture, which is built around each of the E, the S, and the G, proves that one man's trash really is another man's treasure. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces Focus podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of Nigerian voices at home and abroad. I'm joined today by Raymond Onavwigan, who is founder and CEO at Romco Group, which trades and processes non-ferrous metal, founded in 2015. It now employs 180 people in Nigeria, 50 in Ghana, and another 15 in the UK, and is on track to have revenues of £40 million by the end of this year. Raymond has a fascinating journey that has taken him from South London to founding a successful plumbing business while still at university, to his current quest to help to close the sustainability gap in Africa. Welcome, Raymond. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Ethan.
Let's start with your career journey. Where did you grow up? What did you study? And how did you first develop an interest in business?
Yeah, so I grew up in South London, Clapham, to be precise, and on a council estate, as most people, I suppose, do. Sort of, you know, growing up, you know, I had very sort of strict parenting. My parents were Nigerian immigrants who came to the UK in the late 70s. And it was sort of like two worlds, you know, being indoors was you were in Nigeria. And then once you leave the front door, you're back in London, in England, if you will. So I actually studied economics at university. But I also, prior to actually going to university and actually studying economics, I always wanted to do a more vocational course, an early interest in plumbing. And I don't know if it's because of my entrepreneurial roots, why I wanted to do plumbing, or whether I was just kind of traumatized from doing the GCSE exams and realized I didn't want to do any sort of exams ever again in my life. Yeah, so I wanted to do plumbing from an early age, but my parents pushed me down the traditional educational route, like most, I suppose, African homes. Rather than pursuing the traditional university route, I saw practical businesses that assisted people as better suited to myself. And so I actually studied a home plumbing course once leaving university, which I didn't tell my mum about. And this is where I fell in love with that industry after watching Britain's Richest Plumber. Can't lie, it got me really inspired and it worked, right? So I was running a plumbing business instead of finishing university without my mum actually knowing. And I was making money though, so I figured she'd forgive me down the road at some point. So sorry, mum. Yeah, I ran a successful plumbing business. It was turning over £1.3 million in 2012, working at it for about 3 years. So that's how the business track started, right? And that's pretty much the journey. But I mean, I suppose sort of going further back, I did always kind of have an entrepreneurial knack and was always involved in trying to make some money. So yeah, that's kind of always, I suppose, the usual entrepreneurial stories, selling sweets and playground, etc.
Well, we certainly do hear about plumbing as an hourly rate being comparable to graduate rates. So you were certainly quick to pick up on that. So what triggered your interest in the recycling business and gave you a sense of the size of that opportunity?
So I think I'll start with my mum. She was a hard grafter, and I learned from an early age that she was struggling, which taught me the value of money and things were a problem. So I used to go to work with her in several cleaning businesses that she had. And sometimes, because of the family, we all had to kind of pitch in to pull our own weight, right? So I learned that money, wherever it comes from, is valuable and you can find it in everything. The main thing with me, though, is that I knew I wanted that more than the typical sort of house and job, the typical dream. I wanted to build something lasting, something big. So I was always looking to expand, hence the plumbing side of the business had a side of waste management with all the indirect materials we were dealing with. So I realized pretty quick that you can make a pound from anything. So I saw all the massive equipment through this waste management side of the business. I saw the massive equipment that was involved and the value in scrap and recycling. I thought, this is much more me. I actually fell in love with the cranes and the grabbers and the weigh bridges and just the actual operation of a recycling facility and decided to delve into that. So in 2014, I took a trip to Nigeria to kind of see what the continent had on offer, rather, well, the actual country of Nigeria itself, but the continent as a whole. And it was after seeing it really got triggered in terms of taking the trip after seeing a lot of African industrialists on CNN and Bloomberg. However, there was a popular misconception prior to me actually taking an interest in these channels and in economics that Africa was a poor continent, Nigeria was a poor country, and it doesn't have a lot of capital and it wasn't massive businesses operating there like the West. So how these guys were advertising on these channels was pretty confusing at the time, and seeing how this was actually possible. So decided to venture over on a trip, brief trip to Nigeria and see where the opportunity was. Obviously, my roots being from there, it was kind of a no-brainer to start there or see the opportunity that could possibly be presented there. And I was absolutely shocked when I got there. There was a huge amount of waste lying around, huge amount of scrap outside of the airport when I arrived. And when I was on my way back from the trip, sort of fast-forwarding the whole seven-day journey that I was there, the same scrap was still there, right? So that solidified the view and the opportunity that there was a huge recycling possibility or play here. And just in general, once you, I suppose for anybody that's actually been to Africa or Nigeria in particular, there's a hustler's spirit just oozing through the air, and it just runs through you straight away, and you're immediately grabbed to the opportunity and the people. Lagos is a completely different world. It's sort of, can't really describe it in words. Instantly, I just felt like I needed to be there. And again, there was so much waste everywhere. I could see people taking part in the cyclical journey of waste and recycling. And again, it really just inspired me and again solidified the opportunity. So I saw waste and identified waste and recycling as a huge problem and was going to become a big sector. So if I'm honest, I completely acted on a whim. And I came home after the trip and I told my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, that I was going to start a business in Nigeria. And you can imagine her reaction, right? But kudos to her, she really supported me through it. And at this point already, I started buying scrap. I was storing it at the back of my auntie's filling station where she had a spare piece of untapped land. And that was in Nigeria, Lagos. And I was planning to trade those metals, but then realized I had to start sorting through the product, extracting, you know, which we didn't really have room at this place. It was just a small corner. So we needed more space to operate and to do so. So quickly, pretty fast forward to 2015, I decided to venture out on my own after operating on that piece of land and actually bought a piece of land to use as the company's base where we actually are. We're still operational there today. This is a very small section of a very huge acreage now. Over time, we've built up and we're now operating on 3.5 acres over there. So it's really built up quite substantially. In fact, and it's actually going up to 5 acres. So I stand corrected. Unfortunately, at the time, you know, we had limited funds as well to trade. So it was a real struggle. I remember sort of having money to trade with about sort of 10 tons and didn't know how to grow from there because a lot of capital was tied up in the purchase of the land and building the actual property, the actual warehouse at that time. And then I was caught with typhoid and malaria, submitted into hospital, and it was just an absolute mess. It was basically a room with a drip that was supplying me the nutrients, I suppose, that I needed to recover. Fast forward now, I look back and realize I actually thought I was going to die. I was actually close to death. You know, it was like a real life film. It was like the movie Gold. But I did recover, but took a stop and regrouped. So in 2016, I decided to go back to London, consolidate and raise cap. Bearing in mind, in between this period as well, sort of doing journeys to and fro. So yeah, London being the financial capital of the world, decided that I need to raise some big bucks and go back and do it properly. This was a massive struggle, this whole journey really. And you know, I started from nothing. Again, you had to use what was available to me from my auntie's land. But at the same time, it was a blessing in disguise. I didn't know the business to the full extent as I did now, and the terrain, and I would have wasted so much capital if I'd gone in with big capex initially. And that's what I've learned whilst doing business in Africa. You know, the best way is about building business from the ground up and really knowing the terrain and how to operate. We have a statement sort of that on Code Story is like, we know the way because we're building the road, and literally we're building the road. So that's how we kind of know the way. So, yeah.
Well, so many fascinating insights there, ranging from the extreme key man risk that you experienced at the beginning to a concept that actually many of the other guests on this series have expressed, which is around the constraints that come from operating somewhere like Africa and how those constraints foster creativity, but also resilience, because you're perhaps put to the test in a way that you might not be put to the test in another region. So this obviously wasn't your first entrepreneurial venture. We've spoken already about the plumbing business that was also very successful. Why did you think that this would make sense as a solo venture?
Yeah, so necessity, right? I had this drive, and people don't just assemble because you have a feeling or an idea. But to say it's a solo venture isn't completely true. I own most of the company, but I've had people close to me who are now a big part of this venture. And I've pulled together over time, you know, lots of key people to help along the way. We have a strong board, for example. We We have an ex-director from the Easy Group, brand owners of the EasyJet and lastminute.com, and guys from large commodity-based companies and large financial firms across the world. So it's a strong collective. And of course, there's our current investor cohort who have a profound impact on implementing the vision. So they're significant and passionate, and they're a big part of who we are. We're almost a community. I'll expand more on that later, but their support has helped us build two facilities. We've over 300 employees now, and we've turned over a record $7 million in Q2. Q3 is yet to be confirmed, but I think it's just shy of $9 million in the last quarter, but just in terms of our consolidated numbers. So I'd say I'm motivated. I work hard and see procrastination as the biggest challenge to success. I have to go to make this happen. And often sometimes that meant at any particular stage going alone.
And so you're talking about backing there and describing the team you have around you. What was your experience of raising capital initially?
Difficult. As you can imagine, pitching an African operation here in the UK gets a little resistant, right? So that's why we built so much in terms of a strong management team, a robust business model, coupled with top quality equipment and standards, and showcasing that through our reports and branding as much as possible. I know the opportunity on the ground because I'm there and I see it. So it's about being super transparent to show that to people. And that meant assembling the right team of people and getting the right numbers to gain confidence. So we started with issuing our own bonds, releasing our own debt securities to private investors. And it's been a complicated journey that required persistence. And my team knows all about the challenges. But we ended up raising just over £10 million over the past 2 years. And we built two factories and working on a third location. So I think the main thing is confidence. How can you make people confident in your idea or your vision? And that's why we've started with some basic values, which I know can seem rather cliche, but they're actually what we practice and they've helped. Would you like to sort of know them or?
That would be great.
Okay. So number one, we have integrity. And the way that we frame that is we do what we can and we do what is right. And it's as simple as that. Number two being efficiency. Everything can be done better, cleaner, quicker. It doesn't matter where you find the efficiency. It's worth it. And number three being boldness. The world can change for good if we stand up and fight. We're competent, we're courageous, we're direct, and we're good. And lastly, but not least, you know, sustainability. Number four being sustainability. The world needs to be livable, right? And it has to be beautiful. And therefore, growth needs to be supportable and based on renewable principles. So as we build our company on these values, we know we will find people with the same values who instinctively want to partner with us. So the process underneath has been about implementing these across everything we do as much as we can, so that raising capital or aligning resources or wherever it comes at the right time with the right-minded people who are pulling in the same direction. So money with different values attached just won't help us. We want the right money.
It's so important to have a charter like that with core beliefs and core values, because I'm sure the commodity trading business can get a little bit hot-headed at times. Being able to reflect and return to those core values must be extremely helpful. And I just wanted to build on the last one. You mentioned sustainability because you speak about Africa being the biggest opportunity in sustainability infrastructure. What do you mean by this?
So we've highlighted this several times before, and just to kind of recap on this again, Africa is enormous. It's a population with 1.2 billion people and expected to grow another 800 million people to 2 billion by 2040, according to the IEA, right? This is a rise equivalent to the populations of the US and Europe combined. Africa represents a fifth of the global population and yet only produces about 1% of the world's secondary metals. And that's a difficult number to digest when it has been used as a dumping ground by the West for many years. So it's even harder to understand when you appreciate Africa's growing strength as a mining force. So right now, there's an international effort to industrialize Africa, a great race to mine Africa into an economic power of seeing more resources than ever churning out from the continent. So I'll use aluminium as an example because it's our main product for now and it's got enormous recycling advantages. Recycling, it uses 95% less power and emissions than primary production, which requires mining. And it's infinitely recyclable, so it's fantastic, right? There are only around 50 aluminium recycling facilities on the entire African continent. So to give perspective, there are more than 250 in Europe alone. So it's pretty asymmetric there in contrast to the population, right? And it's estimated that only 13% of recyclable goods are actually salvaged and recycled in Nigeria, with almost no formal waste diversion process in place. Again, another perspective is Germany has 65% of all waste is being diverted from landfill. So the potential increase we can make in recycling is enormous. We estimate that we at Romco could increase recycling 10 to 15% in Nigeria over the next 5 years. So we're a part of the clean tech revolution, if you will, that's underway on the continent. And we're firm believers and we think that the real opportunity in Africa is to embed sustainable infrastructure into the design of economic expansion across the region. Circular economic principles are fundamental to sustaining the growth of Africa. So the recycling capabilities must be built as commerce expands and not made on the tack on afterthought once commerce has already got there. So we want to get the most value we can out of the stuff we're digging out of the ground at unsustainable pace. So that's our thought process.
Looking at the market backdrop, we're recording this just before COP26. Do you expect the demand for recycling to grow? And what kind of expansion plans do you have as a business?
Yeah, again, I'll focus on aluminium and copper. Africa has one of the biggest waste problems, but with the global demand for decarbonizing supply chains, there is also an increased demand for metals like aluminium and copper because they're just vital for this green transition that we're experiencing globally. They're needed for electric vehicles, the expansion of the grid, renewable power systems, sustainable housing even, sustainable packaging, and more. So we are responding by building recycling facilities where they either don't exist or they're either underutilized. So we have this five-year vision to build an additional 5 plants, and our research has shown that there's more than enough room in this marketplace to do so. So Africa has one of the biggest waste problems, but that means it's one of the best places to expand recycling, and that's what we're doing and capitalizing on.
One of the most extraordinary aspects of your business, I believe, is just the amount of employment it's created. You've created jobs for over 200 people in Africa and how you're empowering a group of smaller entrepreneurs. Was this intentional or was it just a natural effect of your growth?
Yeah, well, funny you mention that, Ethan. I mean, we employ over 300 now. So yeah, growing quick. We've spent more than 3 million to date on what we call our small business buying program, which acts as kind of like a fund for scrap collectors, metal merchants and trade hubs to expand their collection capabilities and systems to increase the feedstock we can get. And the fund has seen individuals and businesses boom as we grow. So we're actually making a little documentary on this and now to actually showcase some of the stories because they're actually quite cool. So when you see them, yeah, give us a nudge and let us know what you think. So growing local people's agencies to make their own businesses that are big and employs lots of people in the sustainable sphere, that's our vision. Jobs, jobs, jobs. That's what we need on the ground, right? And jobs are that part of the future circular economy and are even more valuable. And we're very proud of this part of the business. But I mean, yeah, going back to owning in on your question, right? I think it was a natural effect of growth and ties into our business ethos of integrity, efficiency, boldness, and sustainability. And more importantly for us, or what I've understood in business, if there's anything I have learned, is by helping more people, you will make more business, if you will. You can only grow. There's only one way to grow, and that's up.
It's absolutely extraordinary. On the point of entrepreneurs in Africa, do you think that they've experienced any particular challenges? You mentioned the hustle of Lagos, and people often speak about, say, Silicon Valley as having an entrepreneurial culture. How do you think entrepreneurs fare in Africa in general?
Yeah, so I think Africa's a very tough place to do business. It's not one for the faint hearted. I'm not going to sit here and make it sound like it's all easy and smiles and nothing can go wrong. It is a tough place to do business, but if you have the right mindset and focus on the right values and work with the right partners, then you can be very successful. But in terms of challenges, I think one of the biggest problems that's facing Africa at the moment is the financial one. Lack of access to capital, or when there is capital available, it's very constrained to a few. And the requirements that the lending institutions over there require are quite substantial. And for somebody that hasn't actually taken off, or for any business that hasn't got off the ground, these are significant issues that are near enough impossible to get on the ladder, as they say in the UK property market, right? So again, there are a lot of challenges, but where there are challenges, there is also opportunity. So again, so far as you can sort of persevere through the challenges, I'm sure you'll be very successful in making it on the continent and just kind of really stick it out. So yeah, there is a lot of challenges though that entrepreneurs do face.
You probably saw this yourself in trying to raise money for Romco. When you were pitching it as an investment opportunity, How well do you think that the African investment opportunity was understood outside Africa? And why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, so we started from relatively nothing. So that's always a difficult pitch, right? People need to know you, they need to trust you, they need to see and understand the vision. So that takes time and confidence in your numbers and your ideas, more importantly. When you add to the mix, the idea is a ground floor opportunity in Africa, starting a recycling factory in Nigeria, you know, where a recycling bed exists, the risk assessment sort of, you know, can compound in a lot of people's eyes. So it was hard, but we have a solid idea. So I wasn't going to let that stop me. Some people have a hang up about Africa, that it's loose and risky and unregulated, but that's not actually the true picture. It's a market that you can be very successful and make a lot of money if you know the people, the ways, and the culture, or cultures rather, especially when you look at the waste problem, right? So not just in Africa, but the secondary resources that need to be made from scrap that is desperately needed all over the world to limit carbon emissions. So solving that problem is always going to make somebody a lot of money. The scrap is there, the waste is there, and the demand is there. So let's build it, right? Also, for us, we're not a completely African venture. We're a UK multinational headquartered in the UK. Our offices are in Chelsea with UK oversight and governance standards. And that's where our experienced board and management helps a lot. I managed to muster and gather people that not only believed in what I was doing, but have experience in scaling up innovative solutions in emerging markets. So when we worked the UK investor market, the British investor market, investors who wanted to see something good done with their money, and those who can see the opportunity in Africa for what it is. It's not for everyone, but those who have partnered with us, they have won, because now we're seeing all the fruits of their investment and working on our next expansion. So to answer your question in short, not everyone sees the African opportunity for what it is. And that's a shame, because it's a very big opportunity to be missing out on.
So what are your thoughts on the current level of diversity in the industries you interact with?
Well, we operate in Africa, right? We have a trade hub in the Middle East, in Dubai. We are headquartered in the UK with trading operations. And our material is sent all over the world, literally all four corners of the world. So we talk to literally every kind of person in almost every scenario. So our outlook on diversity is fairly broad and perhaps a little different to an SME in the UK or the US. Some of the companies we deal with are fairly monocultured, but that's because of the area that they operate in. But if you're talking about businesses around us in London, it's one of the most sort of like multicultural places in the world. And our office has just about every continent represented inside, and that's a huge strength to us. I like kind of what Obama said about the oceans becoming like small ponds in recent times. And in our business, that's very true.
Looking back now to your personal story, I think I'll have to classify you as a serial entrepreneur with two successful ventures already under your belt. What were some of the highs and lows of that experience? And were there any particular mistakes or challenges that you learned lessons from?
Where do I start? I've got a long list here, right? I'll kind of keep it brief with you, Finn. So I suppose moving to a new country without knowing anyone and living alone was pretty tough. Living with no water, no lights, because there was no electricity, rather, and you did have it, you can't gauge for how long it's going to be there. You know, as you can imagine, going from flicking a switch at will, saying a silent prayer before trying to switch on the light to make sure there's electricity is not an easy task to deal with. So Nigeria experiences immense power cuts. Although the national grid has improved significantly, it still ranks poorly for power reliability. There's been many times where I've had to, again, I also grew up being on the ground and working my way right away through this value chain. So again, I've experienced being on the landfills in Nigeria, in particular, one of the biggest in Africa, or it is actually the biggest and most dangerous in the world, which is the Olusegun landfill. Staying there overnight to fulfill an order early on in the journey, that's probably where I got malaria. So, you know, mistakes, plenty of mistakes all the time, but we keep going. For me, I don't see mistakes or failures. I just kind of see it as learning curves and just kind of teaches you what to do the next time around, because it's business, right? It's going to happen. You're going to experience difficulty. So it's just, as I mentioned, learning curves, really. And one of the biggest problems I'll say or would like to touch on, I had with the perceptions I've faced through running a company that operates in Africa, right? Why should people give me money as a British man owning or operating a business in Africa? in response, you know, we've established ourselves as transparent and a trusted business. So working very hard to report and publish as many elements as possible about who we are and what we're doing has really helped in getting that message across.
Very interesting. And looking back now, you mentioned the team around you and you spoke about your backers. But throughout your entire journey, going right back to maybe when you were doing plumbing on the side, were there any key people throughout that journey who really had an influence on you and how you see the world?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a weird one, right? Because you get all the cliches, I suppose, and the obvious names. So, you know, your Richard Branson's, you know, he was a big influence, I suppose, seeing how he came up, etc. You know, your Bill Gates, the obvious names of the early 90s and early 2000s. And then more recently, as you mentioned, into my plumbing days, right? Good old Britain's richest plumber, Charlie Munns, who recently actually sold that company now for £130 million. He was a key influence on, I suppose, on my career slash life. But I think number one has to be my mum, right? Her hard work ethic that she installed on all of us, myself in particular, I suppose, was second to none. And just the core values that she taught me in terms of how to earn a pound note and really anything you're doing, give it your all and sort of never give up, no can do attitude, really, I suppose, resonates on me to today. And every time I get to speak to her, I always let her know how much she's influenced my life and career so far. So yeah, those are, I suppose, the key people who have influenced the journey so far.
And was there any key piece of advice you learned from these people or picked up elsewhere, or any creed or motto that you live by?
Yeah, I always say to everybody, and I suppose this is where I mentioned earlier on about coming back to tell my wife that we're going to do this business in Nigeria and acting on a whim, right? I personally believe procrastination is the killer of all dreams. You just got to go for it. I don't dwell on things, and maybe I should dwell on them more, to be honest, but I tend to act and try to fix later.
So would you have any advice for your younger self? Is there anything that you know now that you perhaps wish you had known as a teenager?
I would say leave school earlier, but no, that's not the case. No, look, in terms of advice for my younger self, I'd like to sit here and say, look, there's nothing I'll change. But yeah, I think actually that there isn't actually anything I'll change. I mean, as we just discussed, right, if I was given more capital earlier on or it was as easy to raise capital, I would have learned the business and might have just burnt through cash extremely quickly. So I think everything has kind of worked out the way it was meant to be. I suppose listen more, but again, goes back to procrastination being the killer of all dreams, right? Sometimes you just got to go for it. So I think the younger Ray done perfect so far. I'll let you know if there's any changes to the younger Ray that needs to be made.
Well, Raymond, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you here. Procrastination is the killer of all dreams. That's what I'm going to take away from this. And I think that you as a person embody velocity, speed, always moving forwards. And you also embody impact. And when we think about ESG, we often think about them as being three very separate things. But I see in Romco and what you've achieved, something that touches each of the environmental, the social, and the governance aspect. And your reference to your values, I think that is so profound. So thank you for coming here and for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Aoife Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.